Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is Willem, your host. As you might know if you listen to the podcast on a regular basis, it's a show where I have conversations and interviews with game designers on a regular basis, and I alternate those with interviews of professionals in marketing and advertising, typically strategy, and it's a lot of fun. I'm still figuring out really my editorial line, and might be repeating myself, but it's interesting to figure out who would be interesting to contact and interview for the show. And since I've started, I've had a list of kind of obvious people that I love the work of and wanted to contact and want to talk to. And then on the way, there's awesome people I come across at a variety of events that I attend or articles that I read online, and then get in touch with them little by little and build it kind of organically that way. And honestly, this is not going to be a subtle approach, right? But it really takes time to organize the interviews, to edit the show, edit the sound, put everything together. And you know, it doesn't take that long that I've experienced myself not so long ago. It doesn't take a long time to post a rating or review on iTunes or elsewhere. Or share the show if you've enjoyed it, of course. You know, if you've enjoyed it, sharing it with a friend. Just click a button, a couple of clicks, share it around with friends. And it's kind of funny because it's really when I started producing the show on a regular basis that I realize how much time it takes to produce an audio podcast. And this is like a completely amateur outfit, right? This is not a professional thing in any way, though. I mean, you know, of course, I try to improve what I'm doing on a regular basis. And it's only since I started realizing how long it takes that I started posting reviews for the shows that I enjoy myself. And realized it really doesn't take a lot of time. So there's two reasons for that. One, given I put a lot of time into it, it's really encouraging when I get some feedback from someone who's enjoyed it. It puts a smile on my face. It's really nice to hear from you guys. And the second one is it really helps the iTunes algorithms. So they would recommend more people looking for new podcasts. They'd recommend this show if it gets more ratings and reviews. And I talk about iTunes because everybody keeps telling me this is the biggest place that people listen to podcasts. And I think it's true. Now, if you don't listen to iTunes, you don't have to, but just it'd be really nice if you enjoy the show that you just give me a shout. And you could do that on my website. You know, post a comment on somewhere on the website or send me an email. The website is at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, ice cream for everyone. Or if you use Twitter, I'm there, so you can send me a tweet. I'm at HippoWill. Follow me on Twitter. You can also find me on Facebook. There's the Ice Cream for Everyone page. Again, just, you know, type in Ice Cream for Everyone. You recognize the little ice cream bar logo. You can post a comment there and like us on Facebook. I say us, but it's really me. So yeah, there's a variety of different ways you can give feedback. If you enjoy the show, of course, you know, if you don't, or if you're not sure, you can just keep it for later. Listen to another episode and then make up your mind. No problem. Now, onto today's show. We haven't geeked out about tabletop role-playing games in a few weeks. And for those who have been following for a little while, but for those who haven't, you can go back and look at it. I gave a talk at the European Planning Conference in Prague last year. And it was a talk about what strategists and really people in business in general can learn from playing tabletop games. And I talked about board games. I talked about cooperative games. I talked about strategy games, like, you know, classic ones like chess. I talked about role-playing games. And I pulled out a few different elements of all of those. The audio is on a podcast episode. It's like half an hour long or something like that. But there's also an article if you just want to read it. So I'll add the links in the show notes. And I particularly talked about this idea that's been in the news occasionally the last couple of years about this tabletop gaming renaissance, particularly thanks to online crowdfunding platforms. And it's one of the reasons I was excited to talk to Luke Crane today. Luke is an award-winning tabletop role-playing game designer. He's particularly known for a fantasy game system called Burning Wheel. And he's also known for the tabletop and board game adaptation of a popular comic book series called Mouse Guard, which is a fantasy series where, well, basically you have mice instead of humans, I guess. So he's designed other games. So recently a game called Torchbearer that is supposed to be going back to the kind of roots of traditional dungeon crawling, killing monsters, earning treasure, and going through a dungeon, like a Dungeons & Dragons type thing, but with different rules. But the two I mentioned, so Burning Wheel and Mouse Guard, he won Origins Awards for best role-playing games in 2006 and 2008, so for both systems. He also gives a lot of talks and seminars about writing and about game design at conventions, at events on a regular basis. There's a couple of recordings I found of previous events, the one that happened in Finland. So I'll add the links on the show notes. And last but not least, certainly not, Luke is also the head of the games department for Kickstarter, one of the largest online crowdfunding companies, arguably the most famous these days because it started replacing as a verb and a noun, like, you know, you kickstart a campaign. And so we talk about crowdfunding. We talk about all the games that are being funded through the Kickstarter platform and what's going on with crowdfunding these days. It was a fantastic talk. We talked about a bunch of different stuff, where Luke is from, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of fun. I hope you enjoy it too. So without further ado, here's Luke Crane. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for making time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Cool. So I'd mentioned before, and that's like the way I start every single one of my interviews, I start with a warm-up question. And this is the warm-up question. So at the beginning of the Burning Wheel version, which is one of the games, well, the main game system that you've designed, there's like author's notes in the beginning in the form of the imps that are in your head that are being shared with the reader.
Okay,
right?
Sure.
So there's three of them. There's the instructor, the ranter, and the weeper.
The weeper, yep.
So I thought, like, if these three guys are talking to you on a regular basis, is there one that's loudest or talks most often?
It's a bit of a cacophony in my head, as you might imagine. Probably the instructor.
Okay.
Yep. You know, the times when the ranter or the weeper take over are not great times. So
yeah.
Yeah. I would say the instructor is dominating the conversation most of the time.
I thought it was a nice way to put author's notes throughout the book. The instructor comes up the most often as well. So
yeah, he does. Obviously that's the voice you should be writing in when you're writing rules texts. But I'd say a marginally successful experiment. It's I think Burning Wheel is too big of a tome to really to be broken down in those voices like that. I mean, I tried to just give it a little character. I mean, rule books are boring to read, and I wanted the book to have a voice. I wanted to be very clear that the book was not going to be like just any other RPG that was being published at the time.
Yeah.
So we really wanted to give it a nice voice, but it's not, I don't think it comes off 100% Burning Wheel. I think Mouse Guard, actually, it works a little bit better.
Okay.
Mouse Guard, I'm really able to break down the voices into like kind of, you know, rules text and, commentary on rules text, and you know, and there's just like the characters, like you can actually go and read the comics and be like, oh yeah, Gwendolyn would say that, like, you know, when you see Gwendolyn's head in the rule book, you're like, oh right, yes, that makes sense.
I admit I haven't read Mouse Guard, actually. So you instead of taking those, you do associate characters from the comic books.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Yeah. I did the same in Burning Empires, but again, Burning Empires has the same kind of problem that Burning Wheel has, is it's a bit of a sprawling tome, so the voice doesn't really carry well. But Mouse Guard, I feel like we actually perfected it.
Cool. So we'll come back into talking about all the different games you've designed in detail. But just to have a bit of background about, you know, who you are and where you're from. Where are you from, actually? Where did you grow up?
The moon. I grew up on the moon. And the playful
field. Was it lonely?
Regolith. You know, flailing in the moon dust. You know that moon dust is supposed to be really sharp? Like, it's supposed to be like little, like, needles of glass or whatever? Because there's no, like, erosion cycle that, like, to wear down the particles into, like, rounded edges and things like that. Anyway, I thought that was a really interesting detail.
It is a quite interesting detail.
I grew
did you
up,
cut yourself a lot growing up on the moon?
I was just covered in scars. I grew up south of Boston, southeast of Boston, Quincy, Massachusetts. The movie that won the Best Picture Award this year, Spotlight.
Yeah.
For those of you who haven't seen it.
And I have not seen it. But
yeah, that's fine. The I wouldn't expect you to, but those of you who the high school in that movie is my high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is not a great thing. It's not like,
You mean the filming location or the actual school in the real story?
The school in the story and in the high school. They go and film at the high school.
Okay.
Or outside of the high school or maybe in the high school. But yes, it's more of a like, Luke went to a high school with child molesting priests at it. Oh, yeah.
That's a... So was that interesting water cooler conversations around the office recently?
Yeah. So yeah, that's where I grew up. Just south of Boston.
Did it match in terms of timings, like with the time of the movie?
I was there just after they ushered those gentlemen out the door. Not that the thing had been exposed. Obviously, the thing doesn't get exposed for another 10 years after that. But
yeah.
They were trying to cover everything up internally.
Yeah.
So
what kind of student were you and what kind of stuff were you into then?
I was a bad student. My favorite high school story is Mr. Pelican. I think my first year Latin teacher, because it's a Jesuit high school, obviously. So you got to learn Latin or Greek. I chose Latin. Mr. Pelican saying, "Mr. Crane, you have a bad attitude." And I was like, I paused for a moment. It was one of those comments in your life that obviously has carried with me for all these years. And I said, you know, he's right. I do. I do have a bad attitude. He's 100% right. I like to think I've maintained my bad attitude all these years. But I was nearly flunking out of Latin that semester. I hated it. Everyone has to take a national Latin exam or something. Every Latin student across the country has to take this exam. And I got like really high marks on the exam. I was like, had like a D minus in the course, but I got these really high marks on the exam. And so my instructors came to me, my parents came to me. They're like, "What the hell?" They're like, "Did you cheat?" Or I was like, "No, it was easy." Like, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it turned out, it was maybe just more of the dynamics. I actually, really loved the learning Latin. And the next year I was able to read parts of the Gallic Wars, Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars. Okay. I was able to like translate it on the fly, and wow. I thought it was really easy. It was crazy. It was this really wild time.
But how would you qualify the bad attitude that you had? Like, what were you like, just disruptive or cynical or annoying or what?
Cynical, I think. I don't have a lot of patience for being like preached at. I get bored real fast and learning like the kind of the basics of Latin grammar is fucking boring as it is. And so, you know, without any kind of basically just learning Latin grammar isolated is boring. Learning Latin grammar in the context of the Gallic Wars is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, that question of adding context to the reason why you're learning is something that's absolutely essential.
Yeah.
And it's funny enough, when I grew up and I was in high school in France, and Latin was optional. Latin or Greek were optional. So for 1 year, you had to do kind of a taster for a semester.
Yeah.
And I only saw and I only learned about like how complicated the grammar was. And I was already learning German. I thought that was super complicated. And that was even worse.
Uh-huh.
And I just didn't, there was no context. And I was asking, so why are you know, what's the value in learning it if I take the optional extra courses of doing this? Aside from, and all I could see as a teenager was that it's a dead language. And unfortunately, nobody gave me any extra context for this. So I just decided it's a dead language. Nobody needs it. I'm not going to do it. It's interesting to hear that kind of text. And if anybody had a conversation with me about how relating it to history or linguistics, you know, putting that kind of like little light in my silly, stupid teenager's head, maybe I would have done it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to be able to contextualize things for anyone, really, but teenagers especially. I got lucky. I think Mr. Moynihan, I had a lay teacher for my second year Latin. I guess my first 2 years. He was really into my crazy translations, because I'd try to put things in the vulgar and the vernacular, rather than like literally translating them. And he really dug it. But it's really helped, like having that foundation in Latin. I mean, even though I couldn't pick up a Latin text now and right. read it on the fly. You know, I'm in Google Translate being like, what is that third declension or fourth or right? But just, you know, understanding the kind of the roots of language and
yeah.
understanding grammar is just simply, you know, one structure out of many, and, you know, and having a kind of a foundational look at romance languages, like it's really helped me just, as a game designer.
Yeah. And were you already playing games like tabletop games and role-playing games at that point in high school?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. When
did you start that?
A couple of years before, just before high school, we started playing.
Do you remember how you found out, or like, was there a special occasion for a first game or for,
I was visited by a coven of witches, and they took me to the forest and tried to initiate me, but then they saw that, I wasn't just this, like, this weird moon child. I was actually a boy, and they cast me out. It's hard to say. Let's see. I think I was actually in Gaithersburg, Maryland for one summer to visit my cousins, my aunt and uncle and their children. Mm-hmm. I think the next door neighbors, we were playing like the NES wrestling game and, well, I don't know, doing whatever, but my next door neighbors there, I think these two Indian kids were like, do you want to play this game? And I said, sure. And, we played, we played like Expert Set Dungeons and Dragons, and I made a dwarf. I made a dwarf and I killed a goblin.
Okay.
And it was the best moment of my life up to that point. It was the most exciting thing. Like, I had an axe and chainmail, and that was it. I walked into a room and killed a goblin. That was over. And then the next day we played Marvel Super Heroes, not even the deluxe Marvel Super Heroes, the OG Marvel Super Heroes. And then I came back, you know, it was one thing to have that kind of like summer vacation experience, like, woo, but, I came back to, Boston. My family lived in Boston at the time, and, mm-hmm. said to one of my friends, like, hey, you want to play these games? I play these games over the summer. And he was like, oh, my brother, you know, played these games with me. He's like, I'm going to run. He's like, do you want to play this game called Paranoia? Ooh. And I was like, sure. And I actually told this story to Greg Kosikian, the designer of Paranoia, years later, that we played it straight. He played it as like a dark sci-fi.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, oh, well. Kind of thriller thing, and you know, or I had to, you know, I was an agent on the run or something, and with trying to find an orange laser barrel or something. Greg Kosikian was like, oh, you poor boy.
Sorry, just for the people who don't know, the game is normally meant as a comedy dystopian future rather than a serious dystopian future, right?
Yeah, it's a black comedy, and I mean, maybe Ohm was trying to play it as a black comedy, but I certainly wasn't.
Yeah.
And then at the same time as well, like, I mean, obviously my brain was fired up, and the first game I ever designed was when I came back from that summer and ripped apart Wizard's Tower, the old Avalon Hill game. You know, has a beautiful map board, and I ripped it apart and created a role-playing game out of it and took it to my friend Joe Howard, at the time, was like probably my, you know, best kid friend of the day. And he made up some like demon warrior, and we went into a cave and he fought gremlins, and he drew pictures of the, you know, his demon warrior dude, like impaling, gremlins on his horned helmet. I mean, it all like, it hit me.
So you're pretty quickly interested in, as much the telling of stories, interpreting characters and rules and figuring out and creating rule systems as well, or?
Yeah. I mean, that's just a real magical thing about the, role-playing games, is that they have this veneer of accessibility, or, you know, kind of intuitiveness to them. Like, oh, right, I get it. We're talking back and forth and we're creating a story together, but there's this medium between us. It's not purely, you know, a negotiation back and forth. There's this other element that we have to navigate. It's very compelling. So,
got it.
So yeah, I mean, I immediately dove in and started
awesome.
And started designing.
So, and then you studied cinema, you know, at NYU, right?
yeah, good research. I went to NYU in '91 and studied cinema. I was in the cinema studies program, which was the kind of academic side, film criticism and history. And I also did film production as kind of a minor. But also like a really lucky thing. Like I applied for film. I didn't really have any, I don't know, like who has film experience when they're 17 or whatever, but they offered me instead either the writing program or the cinema studies program, I think. And I chose cinema studies. It was good. It was a really smart choice on my part, like just kind of accidental, but they just taught me how to think. It was like the perfect kind of liberal arts education and just like, okay, here's a topic that you think you understand, right? Movies. You like movies. Everybody likes movies, 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 movies. And then they, you know, they dive into the, you know, the formal aspects of it and the critical aspects of it, and you know, sociological aspects of it, like really just a really beautiful program. And I didn't do grad stuff there, so I never got too deep into any kind of crazy like theory. Whereas that's when you get really esoteric and stuff. But you know, I wrote essays about the, you know, Rambo, you know, how, you know, Rambo is a Vietnam War film, is a refighting Vietnam War and whatnot. And I mean, I remember I got like my grade on that paper was a fuck yeah. from the professor.
Did you have something in mind particularly, like in terms of, you know, career or jobs, or like what, when you got into that, or when you applied to get into cinema studies?
No, my, you know, my mom pushed me to go into the more art side of things. And I was making these weird stop motion animation films for the past year or two before I went to school. I was taking all my action figures and, you know, setting them up and making stop motion with them. And they weren't very good. But so my mom, you know, we were like, you know, we were renting a video camera for me over the weekend. Like, this is when you could do that stuff. Huge video cameras. And they certainly didn't have a frame by frame on them either. So, you know, my mom was just trying to foster whatever interest she saw in me, which was super cool. But no, I was a really dumb kid. I was like, really just not in tune with myself or the world around me. And so I was like, yeah, okay, sounds good. Like the idea that I would have to like do something and, you know, be able to make money off of it, or be able to not even just sustain myself making money, but to kind of build on it into something else. Like no fucking clue.
Yeah. Don't worry. I mean, I can completely recognize myself in that. I happened to do cinema studies in Paris, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I just saw, oh, cinema studies. I like movies. Let's do that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I had the good fortune of taking this incredible film class. My mom was a college professor at the time. Mm. And, so I got to take classes for free underneath her. And so I registered for like a kind of a contemporary American cinema class at Northeastern University.
Yeah.
So like, you know, my junior or senior year of high school. And I mean, oh my God, I was so lucky. I saw, the two films that affected me the most that I saw in that class were, McCabe and Mrs. Miller by Robert Altman, which is, if you haven't seen it, it's,
I have not actually seen it.
It's an incredible Western, just like really, just fabulous film. Really incredibly well shot. They, I can't remember the name of it.
What's the main plot?
I don't want to say a thing.
Okay. Oh, really? Okay. Is that all right? Cool. That kind
McCabe and Mrs. Miller. It's about McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Okay.
It's very like, if you've seen Deadwood, you're like, oh, yes, wow, this is where Deadwood came from.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. But it's much more like sensitive and touching than it is like vulgar. But it's a similar story. And the cinematography for it is gorgeous. If I remember correctly, they, fogged the entire shooting stock of the film deliberately beforehand. So meaning that, you know, they run it through a camera with a tiny light leak on it. So it exposes it just a little bit. So the film has this really like unearthly quality to it when you watch it. So I watched that. And then the other film that, I saw wasn't part of the class program, but these two gentlemen, brought in a laser disc, to watch, because I guess the class, we had a laser display in the class, so they brought it in. Awesome. Was Akira. The Japanese laser disc of Akira, and I arrived at class. I was a punctual lad, fortunately, and I arrived there, you know, a few minutes early, and they're watching the motorcycle scene, the opening of Akira, and I just lost my mind.
Yeah,
I was like, "What the fuck is this?" I mean, I liked anime,
yeah,
you know, at the time, but I mean, there was just nothing like Akira when it came out.
Yeah.
Like the beauty of the animation, the art, and then of course the kind of the clarity of action. It's just beautiful. And those I owe those two gentlemen a very, you know, a debt for which I'll never be able to repay. They the next week they brought in a VHS copy of that laserdisc, and with, you know, subtitled, not dubbed. And that wasn't even the subtitled version. No, I didn't even, there weren't even, it was a Japanese release and there weren't even English subtitles yet. That's right. And so I just watched it in Japanese. I would come home every day from school or work or whatever, and I would just watch Akira in Japanese over and over and over again. I loved it so much.
Wow. Very cool. It is a very, very impactful movie, and it's an impressive one.
Yeah.
Awesome. So what did you do after university? You start working or?
Yeah. After university, you know, my life just kind of craters. Because I didn't have a plan. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have any skills. And so it just took a long time to kind of, you know, sort that out. I mean, not an atypical story for a, you know, 20 something living in a big city who, sure. You know, I wasn't, I didn't think I was rather hard up for money or anything, but you know, my finances took a turn for the worse. My family's finances took a turn for the worse. I quit school, went to work in the film industry. It was wretched.
Yeah.
And then moved on from there. But while I was working in the film industry, I was at this place called Chelsea Pictures, and they had a graphic station there. They had a Power Mac 9500 or whatever it was called, 9300. And they had Quark and Illustrator and Photoshop on it. And so I would stay after hours, and I taught myself prepress as best I could under those circumstances. And knowing that I would, at that point, that I wanted to be able to make my own books, that skill has also repaid itself many times over.
Were you doing a lot of writing as well, meanwhile, or and before that?
Yeah, I mean,
writing a lot rather than doing writing.
Somewhere around 94, 95, I sat down with a friend of mine and we started like kind of earnestly designing. And so I was, you know, I had a huge Microsoft Word document that I was pouring all my garbage thoughts into.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was terrible stuff, but you got to get started somewhere.
Yeah. So that was the beginning of Burning Wheel, or?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Right around there.
So how did it, you wanted to create your own system, and it's an interesting one because, I'll ask you to describe it a little bit for anybody who doesn't know it. And even I'm certainly not an expert. I've actually never played it.
Sure.
But the main idea is that it's a generic rule system for role-playing games, correct?
Not really.
No. How would you describe it? It's probably going to be better to ask you.
No, it's a fantasy role playing system.
Yeah.
Where it's very gritty and dark. But it scales very well. It can do, you know, like typically like gritty and dark means like low fantasy or something, but it actually doesn't scale on those lines. Like it does simple kind of, you know, like you can do very like Ursula Le Guin style stories in it where you're just, you're regular people, dealing with kind of, you know, really, you know, kind of inflated regular life problems, all the way up to like, you know, elves battling the great dark enemy. It does that power scale very, very well because it really, it focuses on, the kind of internal plot work of your characters, and it rewards players for engaging in engaging with the game in a meaningful way. And in this case, like the prime method of engagement is called playing your beliefs. It's you're trying to accomplish your goals or involve the beliefs of your character in a situation.
Was that one of the main things you had in mind when you started designing the system, as in that might be new and different compared to other stuff that you played or, you know, other systems?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was originally in Burning Wheel, the engine. So that, like, the way it works now is you play a belief. At the end of the session, you get a reward. You spend that reward on, modifying a die roll in the next session. Mm-hmm. Right. It's a very nice, simple engine. It really promotes this kind of momentum of long-term play.
Yeah. And so the idea of the belief is that really is giving more depth and context to a character rather than just, this hero and this is when I'm just going to go kill a couple of monsters and get treasure.
Yeah, which is fine. I play D&D every week, but in Burning Wheel, we were looking for a little bit more nuance. I mean, I was just watching my friends play and I was watching them care about things at the table, and I would watch, like they would say, like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, that fucking NPC, I'm going to murder him, whatever. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. Like, how do we get that involved in the game? Like, how they're so passionate about these things. And like, and you know, they would, we were playing Shadowrun at the time, a kind of extended campaign. And I wanted them to be able to tell me what they wanted in the game and for them to, for them to be rewarded for it, right? For the game to be about that rather than it be simply about me kind of, driving them with a whip like a Balrog into a plot.
Yeah.
But tellingly, in the first iteration of these things were called, the beliefs were called priorities.
Okay.
And the reward system were called brownies. So you got brownies for playing your priorities. One of my friends still wants us to change it back to brownies. He liked brownies the best. But priorities is just, that's a very naked way of saying it. That's exactly what it was. They were player priorities. It's like, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do this. So it really started from there. It was like, okay, well, I know that you want to do these things. How do we incorporate them in the game? Okay, we've got them in the game. All right, but now now we're in a situation where, what if you don't want to do these things? What does that mean? Like, now you don't care about these things anymore. Or what if you ignore it or forget it? Okay, we fine-tuned that. Now we're at a point in the game where you're just gunning constantly. You're like, okay, fine, Luke, the reward system is so finely tuned. I'm just going to do the thing over and over and over and over again. All right, well, this is a role-playing game, and that's, in a role-playing game, you have to be able to make these, what Jared Sorensen calls like suboptimal decisions, right? You have to be able to make a bad choice in a role-playing game. So how do we encourage that? Like, how do we encourage you to have a variety of viewpoints and to engage in a variety of behaviors? So, we keep refining and evolving the system until, what we have here. I mean,
was that something like the instincts where that came into play?
Yeah. Well, instincts are a place in the game to allow you to have your character be awesome. Like, through your character, oh, I just do it. I draw my gun, or of course I remembered to bring this thing, or, their instincts are kind of a defensive reaction, in one way, but, they're also, a way for players to just say, like, my character just does this, leave me alone. It's weird. Like, instincts are not as vital in Burning Wheel as beliefs. Like, we got beliefs so worked out, and honestly, we just got the game. Like, once we work beliefs out, the game becomes something a little bit different. It's not like it. You can't play D&D with Burning Wheel. Like, it's just like the kind of like very technical, like step by step, movement through an environment, and deal with each hazard that comes your way. Burning Wheel actually doesn't do that very well. Burning Wheel moves a lot faster, and like, you want to navigate a dungeon in Burning Wheel, it's probably going to be like just two or three tests. Okay. Like, it's like, navigating a dungeon like turn by turn in Burning Wheel is really boring. The game doesn't support it very well. I mean, trust me, I love navigating dungeons in D&D. Like, and I will make players do it, and I'll make the map, and I adore it. But it just, it doesn't work in Burning Wheel.
What works pretty well in Burning Wheel then?
Just like more, you know, scenarios that are going to kind of move along a more of a narrative pacing where you're going to have scenes and you're going to tackle obstacles in those scenes and, you know, kind of overcome them or have setbacks and, you know, have to try a different way. So, you know, it's not that you can't explore a dungeon in Burning Wheel. It's just that that dungeon, it's going to be like, you know, two or three like important obstacles to get you there. Like, you know, you're going to make, you know, you're going to make a test to navigate all the twists and turns, like, and that's going to be it. And you're going to succeed or you're going to fail. And that, I mean, that's part of the ethos of Burning Wheel. Like, as soon as you have a belief that a character cares about and, you know, there's a reward on the line for it. Like, it just influences the entire rest of the design. And what, I mean, one of the like revolutionary parts of the design, that we put in was like, you test once for something. Like, you can't just sit there and just, you know, throw dice until you pass, nor can the game master continue to call for tests until you fail. It's something I found incredibly frustrating in most role-playing games, but but it, that lends itself very well to Burning Wheel. And so that, you know, if you you know, you're playing at a certain pace, you know, you're, you know, each scene is kind of narratively fresh and like, even if you're tackling the same problem, like, even, you know, you try to confront the problem one way and you fail, well, the game says, like, okay, you have to try a different way. It's not that, like, you've necessarily, like, you know, failed, lost, game over. It's, okay, that obstacle is there. You can't tackle it that way anymore. So now what do you do? I mean, you know, it's like, okay, negotiations are over. It's time to draw swords. Like, just something as simple as that.
And I've heard this idea, I mean, this is this idea discussed in game design that sometimes the rule set is can be better adapted to exactly the style of play and the environment and the setting. But this, so this is a fantasy setting with a gritty environment, but you've also adapted the rule set to other types of settings in your other games like Marl's Guard and Burning Empires. Do you think that, well, basically the question is, do you think the system can be adapted to any style in any context, or is it meant to be versatile in that particular way, or?
No, I don't. No system is universal. No system can be used for everything.
Yeah.
And anyone who tells you that doesn't understand, one, how you're playing the game, or two, game design. I mean, if you look at, I mean, each of those games are their iterations, like Mouse Guard or Burning Empires, Mouse Guard, Torchbearer. They're all iterations, right? So what I'm saying is that you can play Burning Wheel in, you know, or its children in a way. So long as you, you know, so long as you're playing in a setting where, you know, your beliefs matter, where, you know, you can tackle goals in a certain way, you know, where you're going to fight for what you believe, right? That's what we say. That, that's our motto. So, So you can do it anywhere, but like, you can't, like, taking Burning Wheel into Burning Empires, we have to design all these new systems. And then for Mouse Guard, we, you know, we had to redesign the whole game and just kind of keep the kind of kernel of DNA. And the same thing for Torchbearer. Like, Torchbearer, we kind of presented ourselves with a design challenge. We're like, okay, we like Burning Wheel, we like dungeon crawling. How could we do it together? How possibly could we do it together? And so in Torchbearer, much to everyone's chagrin, we realized that, time, like, in order for it to not just be Burning Wheel and in order for it to be a real dungeon crawler, time and resources have to be on the line. And you're, you know, the game has to be about those things. So we designed these two subsystems, which I think were fucking great, drive everybody crazy, called the grind and then just inventory. But it, so it's in order for it to, you know, for the system to work in these other contexts, it requires a substantial amount of design. It's not just something like, oh, just, I'm just going to change a name or two, or we're just going to do it. I mean, you can, but it's just, it's not the same.
And what you were talking about earlier about potentially people not understanding design, is there like a main principle of design that you work by generally, or?
What is a principle of design?
I don't know. I'm just asking questions and see what happens really, but... A belief, perhaps, or a conviction about what makes game, what makes a good game design.
A game should I don't know how to express this, but it, you know, a game should be of itself. It should do what it says it wants to do and do that and do it well. It should evoke, like if it asks a question, right, it should provide you the path to answer that question. And if it, you know, and if you're looking at your design and you're asking all these questions, and you realize that the answers to them don't relate to the kind of core of the design, then you cut them.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. I also participate and contribute to a podcast with friends in France that's more specifically about, you know, details of rules of role-playing games. And there was one conversation I missed. I wasn't on it, but I was listening to it recently where they had a whole conversation and arguing back and forth about author's notes and design notes. And it was interesting because we started our conversation about author's notes. And their argument was basically one person saying, well, it's totally fair for an author to put a note to explicitly say, this is what I mean by my design. But the argument back from somebody else was, well, actually, it should really be expressed in the game and it should be obvious in the design and the rules of the game.
I completely agree with the second statement. I when I first started out as a designer, I was so excited to be able to offer editorial and commentary and author's notes and things like that because I loved reading them myself. And then as soon as I started doing it, I realized that you're papering over bad design most of the time with that.
Right.
You know, very rarely is are design notes or author's notes worth it in any way.
Yeah.
I wrote this whole fucking book of them, The Adventure Burner, and I hate that book. I see that book as essentially a failure in design, right? Like it is an admission of failure. It is what it is. Like, you know, it's out there. I wrote it. But for me not to be able to express those things, you know, that in the design, just it's like I said, admitting defeat.
Yeah, got it. All right, just conscious of time, we're going to move on in terms of topics a little bit. I'd like to talk a little bit about your main job. So you're the head of games for the games category for Kickstarter, crowdfunding company, right?
Yep.
Which, like some people might think, well, I think, it seems like the most ideal or one of the most amazing jobs in the world. It must be pretty cool.
I'm very lucky.
Yeah, it's cool, right?
I am a very lucky human being.
I have a question about that. One of the things, I mean, I have several questions. One of those is, and I'm personally interested in it, I think some other people might be. I'm currently looking at how I can better align my personal interest in gaming with my professional experience. In my case, it's marketing and branding. But I imagine it might be a question for some other gamers out there or budding designers starting careers in various different paths. It seems like you really succeeded with that particular job. And I wonder if, you know, along the way, if you picked anything that you might have advice from other people or other gamers that are looking to, you know, looking for ways to have a job that would be better aligned with their interest in gaming. And I don't mean necessarily like the same job as you, right? But, you know, from my case, it might be doing more work for video games companies to do their marketing, for example. But it could be something else. For a computer programmer, it could be working for a games company. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can't. I can't offer a universal solution or whatever, but I can tell you that what helped me is being involved in my community and not simply designing games. And I am like, I don't always agree with my community. Like, you know, people in my community, I don't love them all universally, but getting out into the community, speaking, helping other people make games, getting involved in their projects, mentoring people, just demoing, just getting out in the community and just sitting down with players like head to head and demoing and like showing them why your game is worth it, why it's good. All of these things are, to my mind, crucial. Like I think that if you're a game designer, you're not doing these things. If you're pretending that you're shy or, you know, you're, I don't want to do those things. I just want to make games. Well, that's fine. But, I think that those are necessary.
Yeah.
In 2016 to be a successful game designer.
Excellent. And conventions as well. That's part of it, right?
I mean, going out to events, going to your local stores, participating in online communities. I didn't start designing games from nothing, right? I've been, like, I didn't publish Burning Wheel Whole Cloth. I, you know, I'd been working on games and on it for years, and then I continued to work on it. I, you know, revised it and refined it 10 years, three editions after it was published. But through all of that, I was also out in the community, talking to people, you know, playing my games with them, playing their games, speaking at PAX, like, you know, doing seminars at Gen Con.
Yeah.
And, you know, that it's made my designs better. And I'd like to think that I've, helped, you know, the game community in a small way too, and helped other, you know, games get out there, and that's good for everyone.
Yeah. Cool. And there seems to be, you know, apparently like crowdfunding, and that's the conversation and the kind of opinions I'm getting consistently, has made a hell of a difference to breathing life back into tabletop gaming in general, role-playing games in particular. So, like, you know, John Wick was on the show as well, and the second edition of Seventh Thieves just finished and broke pretty much all records of role-playing game Kickstarter, yeah. I think.
Yeah, I think it doubled the I haven't looked at the final number, but it doubled or close to doubled the previous record holder, Exalted.
Yeah, which is, and there's a bunch of other quite exciting tabletop role-playing game projects going on. So do you think this is now like going to be pretty much the model commercially for all tabletop role-playing games? Or do you think there's like some other evolution coming later?
Of course. I mean, we will constantly grow and change. I mean, one thing that we're really good at as a community is adopting new technology, and, you know, especially, you know, internet technology has... It's funny that, you know, in the role-playing game world, but we've never been shy about jumping on stuff. Like, you know, we were one of the early adopters of PDF technology and like PDF publishing, us and like software manuals, right? So, you know, there's that. I mean, obviously, and electronic payments, like with PayPal, we were really early adopters of that. So it just doesn't surprise me that, you know, we've made a strong statement in, you know, supporting games through Kickstarter, because one, I mean, all the early adoption of internet technology means that there's a legitimate community that's connected through the internet, and they talk about games, they share games, you know, they play games, so they're out there. And then you know, and obviously the, you know, creators are looking for ways to get in touch with them. And, you know, Kickstarter, just, we've been very lucky that we've managed to become a hub for this community. But I mean, I'm sure at some point they'll, you know, we'll all move on to whatever the next technology is or whatever. That's what we do. But yeah, that, like, I tell, I'm friends with Peter Axon, who's the owner of Gen Con. Okay. And I tell him, I'm like, Peter, are you watching Kickstarter? It's like Gen Con every day. It's just so many great role-playing games launching, and so many, I mean, the tabletop category alone on Kickstarter is just mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is. And it's been growing for ridiculously fast. One other question, in France, and I don't know about the States, because I've not been hearing that as much, but maybe I'm not as close to the community over there. But in France, there's been quite a bit of controversy talking about crowdfunding platforms. Mm-hmm. In this idea, well, there's been one big one lately, which is two different competing companies translating the open gaming license of Dungeons and Dragons at the same time. But that was a whole silly story. But some people have been saying, well, it's not cool because, like, there's really big properties that should really or could really be going through traditional publishing, means. And they're hogging the platform or hogging the limelight compared to independent creators that could be using or needing crowdfunding more. Do you hear that kind of like arguments? Do you think it makes any kind of sense? I'm not.
We hear it every day, and it's a very defensive, specious argument. Like, it, the, we're, I mean, maybe it'll be that way someday, but it is not that way now. What happens now is that people with big fan bases come to use an open platform like Kickstarter, and some of their fans stay behind, right? Some of their fans just come and back the thing, and then we never see them again. That's fine. But I can tell you that some of their fans stay behind, and those people, they look for your like weirdo indie RPGs or whatever, and they back you. And so you have your weirdo little indie RPG audience, and then you're getting some bleed over from, you know, these, you know, other properties with, you know, an existing fan base.
Yeah.
So it really, like, I don't really understand, like, the source of it. I know this thing exists. Like, oh, they're stealing, they're crowding me out. I understand that it exists, but it is not true in any way, shape, or form. It is the opposite. In fact, they are sharing their fans with you.
Yeah.
Is what's happening.
Yeah. And do you think it's also, I think it is, but I mean, it'd be great to hear from you. Is it also opening doors for new people to start again, to be interested in tabletop gaming and role-playing games as well as board games? They might just come to check out other projects and then get interested in that?
Actually, that I don't know. I haven't looked at that exact number of how much bleed over comes back from other categories.
Okay.
Games, tabletop games backers are so amazing and active and generous that every other like category on Kickstarter is trying to imitate them.
Really?
Yeah. Like there, no other category on Kickstarter, no other category in any other platform anywhere has the kind of community that we have in tabletop games on Kickstarter right now.
Wow. Like, I remember looking at some numbers on a website from an article that was from last year, I think. And it was saying that since 2009, there was more money raised for tabletop games than for video games on Kickstarter at a certain point. And it counted video and like equipment.
Yep.
Pads.
Yeah.
And stuff like
I think we, I think we eclipsed tabletop games for the first time. It was close in 2013. And then 2014, 2015, not even close. Like just, last year, tabletop games raised twice as much.
Wow.
Yep.
And what's the advice you most consistently give to new project creators for tabletop games on the platform that are like coming, that come through?
Well, I mean, I'll go over somebody's project with them and look at it kind of, you know, in the mode of the day to see if they, you know, have reasonably priced rewards, they have a reasonable goal. But it's the same. The real advice is the same for anybody, regardless of category. And it's outreach, right? Kickstarter is a platform for you to activate your audience, like for you to get people who like you, who want to like you, to get them engaged in your game and what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, but it's really hard to come to Kickstarter and start that process from scratch.
Right.
Right. If you know, an ambitious young lad or lass, and you want to raise $1 million to start your, you know, MMO RPG, it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
You're going to have to basically win the lottery.
Yeah.
But if you're a creator who has been, you know, kind of laboring in the wilderness for 5-10 years and publishing games, making games, or, you know, or maybe, you know, whether it's physical product or digital product or whatever, and you're, you know, you have a small fan base, Kickstarter is an amazing opportunity to come and, you know, not only, you know, let your fan base support you in a way, but then to allow your fan base to get everybody else interested.
Yeah.
Right. And get, you know, cause that's what happens is that, you know, the chatter starts and the buzz starts, and, you know, from your fans, and then other people look in and say, well, what's going on?
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it on my projects, like, especially, you know, for Torchbearer, like we saw like the first 300-ish people, like we knew them all. We're like, yeah. Yep. Know you. Yep. You know, and then after that, we're like, where are all these people coming from? Like there's another 1,000 people. Like where possibly could you have come from? But it's, you know, there are people that are kind of further out in the, you know, in the circles that want to be involved.
Yeah, cool. I listened to another interview of yours that was published in audio about design. I thought there was two different comments together that were quite interesting. One, and asking for comments, essentially, one was that you commented on the fact that there's a lot of new role-playing games that you're seeing come through on Kickstarter or elsewhere, really, that are kind of naturally copying a lot of the main design elements. So, you know, Powered by the Apocalypse and a couple of other systems that are very, very popular these days, right?
Yeah.
And you also, there was something that you said about the authors of a book called Rules of Play, who apparently the authors of the book were saying they were really having a hard time, if I remember correctly, they were having a hard time qualifying or categorizing tabletop role-playing games. as games, and you said yeah. It's great because it means we're maybe at the forefront of game design. There's a whole bunch of new stuff coming through for role playing games, right?
Yeah. I actually, it's funny. I haven't thought about this, but since I have quoted Katie Salen and Eric Zimmerman there, I've become friends with Eric Zimmerman.
Oh, yeah.
And I have got to take him to task for that now. I got to go back and pull that quote. I don't know where my copy of the book is, but I got to go back and pull that quote and be like, what the fuck? But anyway, that quote originally bummed me out that they were like, oh, role-playing games are weird. Are they really games? I don't know. I don't think they could back it up now. I mean, of course they're games. But when I thought about it, when I kind of sat back and looked at it, I was like, what an amazing thing to say that these games, which are clearly games and which are clearly influencing every other type of game out there, for the past two generations of games, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they're so puzzling to some of the smartest people, in kind of ludography right now, right? They're absolutely smartest, some of the smartest thinkers in culture right now. They're so puzzling that they can't fit them into their model. And I realize that's fantastic that, you know, that means that we're like commodification and, you know, marketing and like all the things that, you know, people are trying to nail down, monetization, like all these wretched things that have been introduced into games in the, you know, especially in the past 10 years, we're like just kind of, you know, dodging around and, you know, staying ahead of the curve. And if you look at what's going on in like the real, like the kind of leading edge of the RPG design, it is so far ahead of any other game design technology. Mm-hmm. Whether, you know, especially things like the, like chamber LARPs, like the Nordic LARPs or chamber LARPs,
What are chamber LARPs? Because I've heard of Nordic LARPs with, well, I mean, the same. Main example I keep hearing about is that you're playing, you know, in rocks on a beach and talking to each other and stuff like that. But
I don't know that one. But the it just basically, you know, a live action RPG that takes place in a single room or in a short period of time.
Okay, got it.
Right, like where you're playing, you know, 2 hours. Through one scenario.
Okay.
The design technology, you know, that they're invoking in these games is really fascinating and very exciting. Like, and these are techniques that are going to filter out into, popular game design eventually.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Like, you know, the idea in video games now and you know, especially like RPG video games where, you know, you can get through a whole scenario in like Mass Effect or just by talking to someone, and you have multiple choices in the talking you're talking to me and you can have a talking skill that helps you get through the talking. And they're like, everyone's like, whoa, this is amazing. And like the rest of us are all just sitting there being like, really? Really, guys?
That is one of the things. It is. And there's exciting times. I mean, when you're reminded, it's probably, I think, still like the youngest form of gaming. What is it? I mean, it's got like the form of role playing games that is being developed is what, 40 years old, really?
Yep.
You know, it's nothing on the stage of games that have been played for thousands of years.
Yep.
And it's exciting. There's a lot going on. And I think there's also opportunities in what's going on in terms of Kickstarter is very encouraging for the hobby to develop and spread. Do you think there's anything that that can be done or that people and gamers can be doing to do the best to spread and tell more people and get more people trying games like that?
Make games, deliver games. Deliver what you promise, but play each other's games.
Mm.
And be respectful of your audience. And, never, like, we are we really are a big grand community here. And so it's very important to preserve that we be respectful of one another and not just in not calling each other names or making terrible assumptions about one another, but by designing good games for one another, and not trying to see each other as like a bag of money that, you know, we're going to slit open and dump out on the ground. Like, you know, designing games that are necessary, designing games, you know, when, you know, it's time for them to be designed rather than like, because, you know, you want to make a buck or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, be respectful of one another, design good games and deliver games.
Cool. Thank you. This was great fun. So Let's finish, and I'm going to finish with a couple of cooldown questions, as I used to do. And this is the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast, so I force an ice cream question into this.
Okay.
Is there a favorite food that you have, or a food that you think would be really interesting and deserves to be made into an ice cream that you haven't seen into an ice cream yet?
Food that dessert. Oh man, I eat all sorts of weird ice cream, so yeah. It's tough.
Like what?
I'm in the middle of like an ice cream renaissance here in New York City. I have an embarrassment of riches. Like it's no longer just like the Ben & Jerry's shop or the local scoop shop. Like there's so many like these frou-frou ice cream shops.
Is there new like craft artisan ice creams going on?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, so I live, down the block from one of the best ice cream shops in the city and probably in the country. It's called Ample Hills. They do lots of crazy flavors, but,
Do you remember one example?
They do some ridiculous, like it's called like caramel crack or something, and it's salted caramel and pretzels and I don't know what, in there. But like I can't like Morgan Stern's, what the hell do they do? Morgan Stern's did a black licorice ice cream, like a salmiakki ice cream, which was amazing. But the problem with salmiakki ice cream is that with the cold and the strong flavor, even though it was like not even like the strongest salmiakki I've ever had, it just numbs your tongue after a while, right? You just can't taste anything. So it's a, but I'm trying to think. What food would I want in an ice cream that I haven't had? I'm sure that hasn't been done. Like Thai iced tea ice cream has been done. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't like savory ice creams. I will admit. Like I'm pretty conservative. Like I just want like a chocolate base with some stuff in it, and you know we'll go from there. Like I can't remember, like Meryl got some like weird black sesame, I don't know what the fuck, at Morgan Stern's. I don't know.
It's okay, don't worry about it. Another last question I do is in terms of marketing and advertising. So and it's interesting also because Kickstarter is generally now used a lot or increasingly by people saying that, you know, we need to connect with our audience, and it's kind of like used it as a marketing campaign as much as a funding campaign for some people. But beyond that, is there like, and plus it's been the Super Bowl was not very long ago. I don't know if you pay much attention to advertising out there, and if you have a favorite ad in mind of something that you've seen recently.
Oh, a favorite ad. I don't watch a lot of TV. I didn't think the Super Bowl was actually very good this year. I thought
I agree with you. I didn't think there were many standouts from an ad perspective this year.
I thought a lot of them were really crass, kind of wretched, like desperately clawing at the, you know, the internet generation who's, you know, on their phone and not actually watching your commercials, on, you know, trying to put stuff in their face. I'm terrible at this. I grew up in the, you know, the Apple generation. So like the like iconic ad for me is the, you know, Apple 1984, Mac ad, which is hilarious and awesome. Like that they're going to smash the establishment or whatever.
It's a fantastic ad from that perspective. Number one, it's like, yeah, it's great. And now after the fact, given how much Apple is like the most established company, the richest one, I think it's even more brilliant. It's fantastic. I'll add the link to the video in the show notes for anybody who hasn't seen it. You should definitely check it out.
Yeah. The irony behind that ad now is just fabulous.
Cool. Yeah. No, it is. It's absolutely. I was funny. I was looking at an interview from Johnny Ive, the chief designer at Apple, with Charlie Rose on Bloomberg yesterday, which was quite interesting.
Talking
about a bunch of stuff from the design perspective at Apple as well. That was fascinating. Cool. So, Luke, if anybody wants to follow you online and I'll add all the show notes. You got the Burning Wheel website, right? That's the main
burningwheel.com. You can head there to see whatever is going on in my world. We've got forums and got a store, and if you want to check out any of the stuff that we have. But you can also follow me on Twitter at burning_Luke. And that's where I'm most active in the social media space.
So you recently published Torchbearer, if I remember correctly. Is there any other big projects you've got game-wise coming up or talks at conferences or anything like that?
We'll be at PAX East later this month, or later in April, excuse me. And I just finished a Kickstarter for the Burning Wheel Codex, which will be a reprint and a re-edit of a bunch of older Burning Wheel material that deserves to be back in print. I last year released Mouse Guard Swords and Strongholds, which is my first board game, which is a two-player.
I wanted to look at that. Yeah.
Light strategy game. Mm. I rather like it. And I am about to go live. I've published three comic books in the past few years, and we're about to finally be able to put them for sale online. They are done, and they look beautiful. So Forge Lord Comics. And Iron Empires.
I just remember the last question I wanted to ask you. I keep reminding, sorry about that. It's the ability to follow a creator on Kickstarter. Is that a feature that you're looking at?
Yes. you can do it through Facebook. And I actually, if you are a member of Facebook, we use the like Facebook API. So you can, if you follow somebody on Facebook, and you turn on the social feature on Kickstarter, it's in your profile, you turn on social, then you can turn on like follow notifications. I use it. It's actually one of the kind of secret great features. If your friends are creators, then you'll see notifications for them.
So it works when your friends are creators.
Yeah. So okay, if we're friends on Facebook and you create a new project, I'll get a notice that says, Willem, created a new project and launched a new project.
Okay, got it. So the best way is like if there's anybody that you really want to follow the projects of, be friends with them on Facebook, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, eventually we'll move off and have our own social integration. It's just going to be some steps to get there.
Got it. Well, thank you very much. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, well, that's another episode wrapped up. What a fantastic conversation I had with Luke. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun having it, so I hope you had as much fun listening to it. If you've enjoyed, as I said at the beginning, how about sharing it with a friend? Just, post the episode, forward the email on to a friend of yours, or post it to the social networks that you're part of, whatever it is. Like, if you've enjoyed this, you probably know somebody else that is a gamer or might be interested in hearing about tabletop gaming and hearing about game design a little bit more. So you can also just separately find more Ice Cream for Everyone goodies to read or listen to. There's a bunch of other episodes of the podcast. Check them out. Or on the website, you can find and sign up for my weekly newsletter. That's Ice Cream Sunday, sent every Sunday, obviously. And the website's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything's spelled out. And in the newsletter, it's kind of a long-form article, something just usually light, and the intention anyway is for it to be enjoyable to read, kind of interesting. The topics vary wildly every week. I usually go from some kind of personal experience and then expand out from there. The last I wrote was just Easter, so I wrote about Easter. The one before was about memory. I'm preparing one about the nature and functions of dreams, so it really varies. There's another one I'm preparing and writing about classic video games, so and my gaming experience, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, you can also find Ice Cream for Everyone on Facebook and sign up for the updates. You can just like the page there. You can also follow me on Twitter. My handle is @HippoWill. And that's about it for now. Thank you so much for listening once again. And until next time, see you later. Bye-bye.